Welcome to the Fermentation Speaker Series from the Center for Human Microbiome Studies at Stanford University School of Medicine. I'm Aliza Caffrey, a graduate student in the Sonnenberg Lab here at Stanford.
I'm David Zilber, a chef, food scientist, and author specializing in fermentation.
I'm Justin Sonnenberg, professor of microbiology and immunology at Stanford, and my lab studies the gut microbiome.
Our goal is to open up conversation around the current understanding and knowledge in the fermented food research space, and to define and promote future fermented food and health projects. We spend so much time talking to researchers around food fermentation, but we really haven't spent as much time talking to those that actually make and practice fermentation daily. And so we wanted to take the opportunity to talk to Alex Hosvin, who has been fermenting at the Cultured Pickle Shop in Berkeley with her husband, Kevin Farley, for over 25 years now. This is a recording from the live Zoom conversation we had with her on April 18th, 2023.
Thank you all for joining us. I'm David Zilber. And on behalf of my co-organizers, Aliza Caffrey and Justin Sonnenberg, I want to welcome you to the Fermentation and Health Speaker Series from the Center for Human Microbiome Studies at Stanford University School of Medicine. Last presentation a couple of weeks ago with Dr. Joshua Evans, we had a great conversation with him about the use of fermentation as a way to explore relationships in the case that he presented between sustainability, culture, and flavor. Fermentation research is still in its infancy, and that's why we're doing this series. And to explore these relationships, we still need to understand the basics. What microbes are present and involved in the processes of fermentation? What are they doing in there? And how are they interacting with each other? We also need to recognize current limitations in scientific technology. For example, while we might want to quantify certain compounds associated with taste and flavor in fermented foods, the ways in which we do this, can combine taste with texture, temperature, and emotion, leading to perceived flavor that can't be quantified with a scientific instrument. But nonetheless, we require the collaboration of chefs and scientists from many fields to be able to do any of this. Like most things, understanding the relationship between sustainability, culture, and flavor requires practice. And the best way to learn about fermentation is to gain experience by listening to microbes, developing an intuition for what will be a success and what might not, all while keeping up with the regulatory landscape and changing consumer tastes. But before introducing our next speaker, a little housekeeping. This series will be recorded and posted in the next few days as both a video and audio. Feel free to write in the questions as we go, upvote your questions that you like, and we'll do our best to get to them. Thank you to everyone who submitted questions ahead of time. And now I'd like to introduce our speaker, Alex Hosvin. Alex has been fermenting since 1996 with her husband, Kevin Farley. Over almost 17 years of fermentation practice, she has experimented fermenting a bit of everything, from watermelon rind, katsuzuke, to natto miso, along with a constant rotation of sauerkrauts and kombuchas that you can find at their shop, their famous, famous shop, the Cultured Pickle Shop in Berkeley. With her fermentation experience, has also come years of navigating the regulatory landscape and observing changes in consumer perception and marketing of fermented foods. So it is a great pleasure to have you here, Alex. I've never been to your shop, but next time I'm in Berkeley visiting my like college days ex-girlfriend and saying hi to her, I will also come by and get a bowl of rice and pickles in a long overdue visit to your mecca of fermented foods. So please take it away. We're so happy to have you here.
Thanks so much, David. I hope you do come. So I would say that probably one of the most common questions we get from customers is how we began our interest in this business. And pretty much like most questions I get asked regarding this business, I don't really have a super neat and tidy answer for you. But I would say that really the beginnings for me started when I was 18 years old and adopted a vegan diet. And I had zero idea about how to feed myself. So it became sort of a lifelong exploration into that question. And I navigated through various alternative diets throughout the years. And at about the age 20, about age 23 in 1994, that's when I met Kevin and we adopted a macrobiotic diet. And macrobiotic diets, they rely heavily on traditional Japanese fermented foods. And we soon became very enchanted with miso, both, I think, because of sort of the hypnotic beauty of watching the swirls of miso in your bowl of miso soup. And we eventually married ourselves one evening over a bowl of miso. And so we decided we were going to learn how to make this rather magical food. There wasn't a whole lot of information at that point in the mid-90s. There was no internet, but we armed ourselves initially with this book, The Book of Miso, that we found at a used bookstore. And somewhere in the back of this book, in the appendix, we found the address of a business called Gem Cultures. And very serendipitously, we happened to be living quite close to Gem Cultures in Fort Bragg, California. And so one day we hitchhiked out to the coast and we showed up on the doorstep of Betty and Gordon McBride, who were pioneers in the field. And in their kitchen laboratory, they both imported koji-making spores from Japan and cultivated a huge range of cultures, everything from kombucha to sourdough to more obscure Scandinavian dairy cultures. We were totally enthralled. And they sent us home with an envelope. They sent us home with an envelope of koji-making spores. But home at that point, and I'm going to show our first picture. This was home. That is the view from the tent we were living in on a small organic farm in northern Mendocino County off the grid. So the conditions at that point for fermentation were rather rustic. Our first incubator was a sleeping bag on the side of a sunny hill. And so we kind of took it from there. And we definitely learned how to be resourceful, without a lot of fancy equipment, which I think is one of the best gifts that starting this way has given us. I think that in this business, being able to sort of observe what you're seeing and respond with the knowledge that you have is the best skill that you have. And I also think that so many of these processes, which arose out of a very intimate relationship between human and plant and microbe, that evolved in more agricultural settings, I think starting in this way really was great. The goal was never to start a business. Really, it became more of a hobby. And we were exploring possibly traveling to Japan to study miso making. But we had a child instead. And we moved back down to Berkeley, where I had gone to school. And it was really in pregnancy that I discovered lactic acid fermentation. It's fairly cliche, but I did crave sour and I did feel fairly ill. I think the other sort of large influential book we had was this book called Healing with Whole Foods by Paul Pitchford. And somewhere in the back, there was a recipe for raw sauerkraut, which I'm sure our first couple batches turned out quite horribly. But eventually, you know, we got some basics down. And our son was born in 1996. And we were broke. And Kevin was in a rather dead-end job. And I tend to have a hard time sitting still. So I was trying to find something that I could put the baby in the backpack and better our situation. So we, at that point, we built a greenhouse in our backyard. We started growing sprouts and wheatgrass and microgreens. We rented space by the hour at a community kitchen. And at night we would go and we would pound and we would shred. And then we would pack everything into 5-gallon crops and we couldn't store anything there. So we would haul it back to our tiny apartment, and all available floor space was taken up with pallets that were loaded down with 5-gallon crocks, and all available wall space was steel shelving that had more 5-gallon crocks. And there were old refrigerators that were used as incubators. And that's how we began, really. We really couldn't have started this business, I'd say, anywhere else. There was a fairly niche audience that became fans of what we did. Mostly, I'd say people that were more in the raw foodist community. Let's see. So we started selling sprouts at farmers markets. We started doing some small batches of sauerkraut. And that was really our first jar, looked like that. In 1999, we started sharing kitchen space with a catering company. And then due to the rather sort of quick turnaround time of sauerkraut and a higher customer demand for that than miso, we decided that that was going to be our main product. So the biggest leap the business really ever took was in 2006. We leased our own space, which is what this is a picture of in the early days. And we built out a kitchen. There was a front door to the sidewalk, so there was the possibility of doing direct retail. But in order to pay for the space, we needed to make a lot of kraut. And so we started, I'd say at that point, we were producing about 2,000 pounds a week. So at any given time, there was about 10,000 pounds in production. It was around the time when Whole Foods was opening stores left and right in the Bay Area. And we were, I think, one of two companies on the shelf. And so things went along pretty well. But we could sort of see where the market was heading. My understanding of the growing awareness in the importance of probiotic foods was through the fact that stores were ordering a lot. But eventually the market, this is our fermentation room that was lined with about 30-gallon stainless steel wine fermenting tanks from above. We did eight flavors of sauerkraut at that point. But really within a few years, the shelves of supermarkets started looking like this. And so we understood that we needed to start to transition into a different kind of business. That really would be more sustainable for our future, but really more genuinely reflect who we are. The great thing about having a space of one's own is that it allows for the freedom of experimentation. So as far as the lactic acid fermentation that the shop produced, we really wanted that to reflect the amazing year-round diversity of agricultural bounty that this region produces. So just a few pictures of some various different vegetables that we work with, a pumpkin, some cauliflower, some watermelon rind, some carrots and seaweed, some celtuse. So, and what we produce will change throughout the season. The krauts we still do, but less of them. And at any given time, we'll have dozens of different specialty lactic acid ferments. Beet green kimchi, a romaine. One of the really very fortunate parts about our new shop is that we are literally right down the street from Takara Sake, which is one of the country's largest sake producers. So right away, we wanted to do a deeper dive into some more traditional Japanese pickling techniques. One of those being kazusuke, in which we're utilizing the lees or the solids that are filtered out during sake making as a fermentation medium. So a rather lovely picture of turnips and pumpkin. We started doing more rice bran pickling, some drying, which in which we're air drying the vegetables first. Also some daikon. A lot more with umeboshi plums that we've gotten much better at over the years. And we revived our miso making program in sort of smaller batch, younger misos. I had brewed kombucha off and on over the years, but mostly at home. And I decided to bring that down to the shop. And that's really the main beverage that the shop produces. Kombucha, for some reason, more than any other ferment, I feel like, has this very rigid orthodoxy that has grown up around it, in which you can only sort of brew on certain teas and with certain sugars. And so I very much rebel against that. And I really enjoy growing my SCOBYs on a variety of herbal teas. We also utilize a lot of vegetable juices in the secondary fermentation of the kombucha. And what we found was that as our retail fridge really started to look more full and diverse and interesting, and that at the same time as people really wanted to add more fermented foods into their diet, we found that a lot of people would stand in front of the fridge or, you know, at farmers markets, and they would be a little bewildered. And one of the most common questions was, what do I do with this? And so we, both in a way to try to bring more people into the shop and provide some context for what it is we do. In 2016, we started serving lunch. And we came up with the idea of doing what we called rice and pickles. I love sort of the beautiful simplicity of it, in that so many traditional diets really rely on a staple grain with some fermented condiments. But the concept was broad enough that we could sort of showcase the breadth of the work that we do and that we've been working on for decades. So the components of the bowls will vary from things that are hours old, say some tomatoes pickled in koji, or some amazake that's produced out of the leftover rice from lunch and then converted into a sweet porridge for dessert. To things that are, you know, several years old, such as this kazusuke watermelon rind. One of the other really wonderful things about rice and pickles is it allows the shop to operate less as sort of a linear production line and more as a whole kitchen ecosystem. So, for instance, various components of our production are recycled into other components of the bowls. So this were some carrot peels that were dried and then simmered in a white miso last week. We'll take various pulps from juicing and we'll turn them into dashis. We'll turn them into spice blends. So we're able to walk people through their meal, through their bowls, using kind of this lens of fermentation, in which everything is always in the process of becoming something else. So last year, we completely ended all of our wholesale operations. So that transition really took, it took several years. It took 30 years completely, but it took several years since we decided that was the goal. And now we sell only direct to customers who come here to the shop. And the range of customers we have, it's amazing. It's one of the most unique and special aspects about this business. We have everything from people who were sent here by their gastroenterologists to chefs and craftspeople from around the world. The reason I think that's so special and unique is that those worlds used to be very separate. And I think And I think that that they really don't need to be. I think that when we speak about fermentation and health, like so much of nutritional science, that the conversation is very reductive, that X probiotic can be used to treat X symptom. And I understand the usefulness of that, but I also think that we're working towards something larger and more long lasting. I think that when we consume ecosystems to feed the ecosystems that live within us, that over time we become more resilient to the various stressors that we face. And when the food that feeds us is really delicious in a deeply nourishing way, that it becomes not just the food that we're supposed to eat, but the food that we really crave on a deeper whole body level. And when our brain and our gut are clearly communicating, then I think we just make better food choices. So I think initially a lot of people come here because they're told to come here, but over time, I think that they start coming back out of a more internal motivation. I see that all the time. And I think that that really is how I understand the activism that's inherent in what we do. And I'm happy to discuss any of that with you further.
That was great. That was a fantastic, it could be a movie.
There's a lot there.
The little culture shop on the prairie or in the mountains, I take it, that wound up on Main Street in Berkeley. That was so amazing. I didn't know all of that back history. so great to learn about that. And also to, you know, I just had a kid myself, and to learn that like your kid was kind of like the catalyst for all of this coming about is also so beautiful. Very, very cool. I'd love to kind of dig into some of the last portion of what you started talking about in relation to health, especially when you mentioned that some of your clients are actually sent to your shop by their doctors. Can you expand on that a little bit and talk about what people come in looking for? And if they're like even bringing in prescriptions for meal changes, and if nutritionists get involved and so on and so forth.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like, we've always been, it used to be maybe more that people's acupuncturists or their herbalists or we're sending them to us, but really that's not the case anymore. I mean, we get, doctors from Kaiser are sending their patients to us. So the mainstreaming and just it's evolving so quickly. And even, you know, people used to sort of think that they would take their lab grown probiotics in addition to their fermented foods. But I've had people more recently whose doctors have told them that really a lot of the probiotics they're taking were causing more harm than good, and that they should really be focusing on diversifying their diets. So I see that all the time.
Very cool. And speaking of that, you also, there, it was a while ago, it might have even been like a year ago, I posted like an Instagram reel of myself making pepperoncino in my lab here. And in the description, you know, I wrote, you know, it's like cooking the pepperoncino is a super important step. You can't just like raw pickled chilies. It's not the right flavor. Like this is how Italians have done it for ages. And this is how I'm teaching you to do this. How I learned how to do it when I was 18. So please like blanch and pasteurize. You know, and sometimes your microbes have to die for your food to live. And you commented that that's something that your clientele, or maybe the more militant among your clientele, or the clientele that get kind of maybe blindsided or caught up in this idea that, you know, the probiotic aspect of these foods is the most important part. And you said that, you know, that's kind of like a line of messaging that you would use in your work to kind of combat these misconceptions. Can you speak to that a little bit?
So, I mean, the probiotic content of what we do is so, you know, it's integral to the process. But again, I think that the sort of the over clinging to that, you know, becomes sort of part of this reductive paradigm where I'm, you know, eating X food to get X thing. When you really make probiotics just one of your basic food groups, then I think that whether or not you happened to cook a particular thing is fairly irrelevant. You know, a lot of customers will, you know, right away be like, oh, but you know, could I cook that? You know, I wouldn't want to destroy that. And it's like, well, okay, that's, you know, that's up to you. But really, you know, everything here is living and dying all the time, both in this product and within you. And if you just sort of think of them more as just one of your basic foodstuffs instead of X dose of X thing taken for X amount of time, then I think you start to let go of some of that sort of overly precious quality. I totally did pepperoncini raw. I had no idea that you were supposed to cook them, but I thought they tasted great.
Yeah. I mean, that's just what I've learned is that, you know, it's like the blanching step, and it's like, I think it's like an Italian Nona thing. Like it's meant to go in the cellar, uh-huh. Cook it, blanch it like with the tomatoes, and then keep it on your walls. I was taught by like a Sicilian chef. So that's but hey, we're not being militant about anything here. That's the
point. No, I just, you know, I like to try things out. Yeah.
Great. Alisa, Justin, do you guys have any questions off the top of your dome?
Go ahead, Alisa, if you want to go first.
I was really interested in also the, as you've kind of built your practice, the regulatory landscape, and how that's changed in terms of, you know, like your readout, what you're interested in is flavor and just making something that's good, where you have, you know, regulators that are interested in how much E. coli is currently present in the food. And so just kind of how you've navigated that and how that's changed over time, and also where you see it going, how have rules and regulations changed, and what are kind of movements that you've seen in terms of the way in which you can actually start producing and continue to produce and sell your food?
Yeah. So this is the only food business I've ever had, so I can't really compare it to any other food business. But really, and I think there is sort of an initial idea that the regulations regarding fermented foods must be so much more difficult than other food businesses. I haven't found that to be true. I mean, first of all, depending on where you are, you're going to be dealing with different types of bureaucracies. There's no one overarching bureaucracy that everyone's going to deal with. You're going to deal with your local health department, and depending on the level at which you sell, perhaps your state health department as well. But really, I mean, everything that we do, it is radically safe. You know, you are dealing with a very low pH and a fairly high salinity. And even within those health departments, within the regulations, there are particular regulations that pertain to what are called non-PHF foods or non-potentially hazardous foods, which are foods that are below a pH of 4.1. And so, you know, I speak that language. That is the language of most of the health inspectors that will come into my shop. And so we can speak on a level that everyone understands. It's not that I care about flavor and you care about E. coli. Like we can speak in a way that we both understand. And in general, you know, it can be different depending on a particular inspector on a different day. But I can't say that I've ever had any hurdle that was, you know, totally unrealistic. One of the greatest things about our sort of contraction and our deciding to pull out of the wholesale market and sell direct retail is that really at this point I only deal with our local health department. The licenses that you have to have are going to really be decided by the level at which you sell your product. I've found really that the most effort and expense as far as bureaucracies have been with my organic certification, really more than any health department. But again, it's so dependent on where you are specifically, that I can only speak, you know, from my own experience here, which in general has been, you know, challenging, but not impossible. Yeah.
Awesome. Please go ahead, Derek.
Just to continue this line of thought. Have you ever, and because this happened to me when in my time at NOMA, that, you know, in certain instances, it almost felt like I was teaching the health department about the safety of some of these foods as they were coming to do the inspections. Like they're like, okay, your fridges are good. We get that. All right. Everything in the dry storage looks proper. But what's this mold? Like this doesn't have a low pH right now. How can you prove that this is safe? Like, and they didn't have the capacity to check that my systems were good. Have you encountered situations like that when you go into novel fermentation or outside of just pickles?
Yeah, there's been some education, but I feel like in so many ways, inspectors that come in, you know, they sort of pick a particular thing and then they want to spend hours on this particular product. And, you know, since the sauerkraut was the product that we produced in the volume, in sort of a volume way, that was really what we tended to focus on. And it's very easy to communicate that that's a radically safe process. You know, some of the smaller batch things we do, you know, they're, you know, not the most obvious things in the shop. And so they tend to not draw a whole lot of attention. But really I've found, and you know, I mean, health departments, especially at this point are so overwhelmed that, you know, I don't get a lot of people in here. And in general, if you, you know, fill out what you're supposed to fill out and pay what you're supposed to pay and keep logs, like you're supposed to keep logs and keep your place like clean and are respectful. And, you know, like it generally is pretty okay. I feel like it's one of the questions that people who start businesses, you know, want to talk to me about. But it's certainly not I don't think it's any more of a hurdle in this business than any other food business.
Maybe related to this, but maybe delving back into kind of food and flavor and maybe away from safety a little bit, you know, it strikes me, Alex, I think at one point you said that you love to rebel against orthodoxy in fermentation, which I loved. And I think between you and David, we may have two of the most most experienced people maybe on the planet in delving into new areas of fermentation. And so I would love to hear just a little bit about successes, failures, whether you've run into boundaries. You know, I ferment at home, but I find it very, you know, easy to set up something that's repeatable, and I can get caught in the trap of just like doing the same thing over and over again. Maybe some ways to kind of break out of what you're doing at home and try new things. But yeah, I would just love to hear some great stories about cool things or failures in these different experiments.
Yeah, I mean, failure, like if you can't deal with failure, you're just in the wrong line of work. But you know, I tend to think of it as like a very good lesson in detachment on a daily basis. But even with things that I do over and over again, I mean, that's sort of the tricky thing about this. You can do the same thing over and over again, and it can seem as simple as possible, but you can do it one day and it's textbook perfect, and you can do it the next day and like, what the hell like just happened there? So I never necessarily, sometimes I think that the most simple things are the most challenging, because you know, you're dealing with like a very few ingredients and using one process. And so it really has to highlight like your skill and the ingredients that went into it. You know, but as far as, I mean, we're just so, there's just so much to work with. I mean, the amount of the different plant diversity out there is just like, I'm just constantly inspired with what we're able to do. I mean, in general, one of my rules of thumb as far as things in sort of the lactic acid fermentation world are, you know, if it's pretty enjoyable to eat raw, then it's going to be pretty enjoyable to use as a pickle. One of the things I make a lot of various kimchi. I've been enjoying doing them out of lettuces quite a lot, which most people are like, what, you know, like that's going to turn totally mushy. But really it doesn't. If you're using the right salinity and the right temperature, you can get just a lot of really beautiful textures going on in there. That's what's, you know, kind of in my head at the moment. I mean, I think that the lunches have given us such a great platform to, when I sell something as a product, then I need to feel very confident that it's going to stay in a jar in your fridge and not change very much over time for several months, because that's what people sort of expect. When we do the lunches, I feel like we're able to, say, use a lot of the mediums that are produced in the shop and the byproducts that are produced in the shop, and use them to create various quick pickles, you know, that are really lovely for, say, a couple days, but then are going to sort of go downhill. They really allow us to sort of use our creativity in a way that is a little less static than like some of the longer term pickles that we do. I have a lot of fun doing the desserts for rice and pickles. Most people tend to not include a lot of vegetables and ferments in desserts, but I think they work really beautifully, especially with a sweetener like amazake, which has so much complexity and depth to it.
When you go into like a new substrate, like a new vegetable or something, are you backslopping or using starter culture, or do you just kind of take
your chances? Oh, I hate that word.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, I understand, but you know, I know it's generally something I don't. I think that at least in lactic acid fermentation, backslopping often it often goes along with a sense of fear. You know, that what I'm doing is not good enough, and I should take some of this thing from a previous incarnation. That's just not true. You're taking a certain ingredient and you're providing the conditions for the proliferation of the type of microbes that you want to transform that vegetable. And you can do that. I mean, that happens. There's no need to sort of have this this kind of, oh, it's just not going to be enough. And so I always start new every time. Yeah.
I'll just chime in, but it's also just from my own research. If you do backslop using, you know, the previous brine of a lactic acid ferment, you end up with a super screwy ferment the next time, because you haven't allowed the community progression to take place. Hmm. Because there is this unfolding. You'll have Lucanostoc at the beginning, and then you'll have Plantarum at the end. And you won't get the same flavors, and you'll usually end up with like a very one-note, very sharp ferment instead of the complexity, because whoever was supposed to come late to the party was there from the start and just like shoved out everyone else.
Totally makes sense. Yeah.
We will use brines to make, say, quick pickles for rice and pickles. Yeah. So I am able to use them in that way. But I think that's totally true, David, that the natural progression, you're just not allowing that process to unfold.
Yeah. We'll go into the Q&A. Rajan Singh, great insights, learning so much from this platform. Thanks a lot. A quick question. What next or next generation probiotics for personal use medicine, I suppose, maybe you meant, are on the horizon? maybe there's some fermented foods that's made unique for someone to improve their health. And I think maybe what Rajan's asking is, are you seeing people come in asking for specific things? And are you kind of changing your habits to be like, okay, yeah, yogurt in this, or maybe villi or fermented grains or something with an alkali ferment? Are you kind of catering to what the public is asking for in this way?
Yeah, I mean, the public usually is asking for a lot of people that come here for the first time. It's like a, what do I do? What do I get? What's the best? And I tend to not sort of cater to that question. I say that if you want to create a diverse ecosystem within yourself, then you're going to really want to include a wide variety of probiotics. So both lactic acid ferments that are old and young, and along with kombucha, and along with miso, and along with yogurt, and along with a variety, as much as you can find, and then to include as many different high fiber plant foods to feed those probiotics in your system. And eventually, you know, if you feed them, like they will stay. So it really is more of a whole sort of lifestyle rather than a prescription of one thing over another thing.
Do you have any customers that only eat your ferments?
As opposed to other companies or their own?
Yeah, like they come in and they're saying like, you're the only place where I buy my fermented foods. And I,
yeah, I mean, I think that, I mean, I definitely get a lot of customers who will say like, you know, I don't like kombucha, or I don't like sauerkraut, or I don't like this or that. And I try to sort of communicate that, like, that it's not just because you've had a certain product, like that is not the end all be all of that product. That especially in this world in which that I think does not take well to mass production, that a lot of what is out there on a larger commercial level, and there's so much now, I don't really keep track at all. Truthfully, it's not very good. And I think that is because, of, you know, that scale is important. And then because it's not very good, I feel like it's, you know, overhyped and overmarketed to save your life. And so that's why people, you know, will consume it. But when they come to us and they start to, you know, eat the food that we produce here, it is sort of a revelation of like, you know, oh my God, like this is great. And that's, I think, where sort of the, you know, the ideally sort of the, what will eventually just get them to eat better over time, not because it's good for them, but because, you know, it's the food that they really want.
Yeah, totally. Maybe Justin, you can also touch on kind of the differences between what we're seeing in the grocery store in terms of probiotics. And I know like there's a lot of addition of probiotics at the end after pasteurizing, et cetera.
Yeah, right. Totally. I mean, we ran a study a few years ago where a group of people, we just asked them to eat as much fermented foods as possible. They could make them themselves, but most of them got them at the grocery store. And our guidance was basically to, buy foods in the refrigerated section, make sure that they've, you know, haven't added just acetic acid to them, that they actually have been fermented and contain live microbes. We documented certain products in the lab that they actually had live microbes. And it was pretty straightforward. Like the, you know, I think we ran the study in 2017, 18, something like that. And we're redoing the study now, but in a different cohort. And it's become way more complex. I mean, there's just so many companies out there you can tell are playing off of the popularity of fermented foods and, creating brined foods that then they add, you know, a spore-forming bacteria to that's kind of shelf-stable or will survive a long time and say contains live microbes, you know, and, you know, get these pickles, you know, probiotic. And there's just a wide variety of foods like that. Kombuchas that have probably been, you know, made as kombuchas, but then pasteurized. And then again, like microbes added back to them. And so we're trying to go through and figure out what foods actually have live microbes, which ones have actually been fermented, but the marketplace has become a lot more complex to navigate. And I don't know if you have any comment or guidance on how a consumer out there that doesn't have access to a shop like yours, how to get good quality fermented foods from a store.
They should just make them. I mean, it's predictable, you know, when a food is just becomes trendy that like the large players involved are going to, you know, sort of move in and everything's going to sort of shift to the lowest common denominator. And you see it happening. And, you know, I'm sure that there's small businesses that are doing, you know, probably farmers markets. You're going to start having, you know, you're going to have smaller producers doing things in a way that just have more integrity. But even like the small businesses, you know, that are being sold at supermarkets, like those are being bought by larger businesses. And so, you know, I do see like you're entering into this world where now things are going to be labeled as postbiotic. You know, and it's just, you know, and it sort of then again feeds into this reductionist paradigm where, you know, you're just consuming chemical processes instead of actually consuming systems in and of themselves. So I think either you're going to find a small producer or you're just going to, you know, start to take up some space on your countertop. And it will hook you in.
Totally. And just to chime in there, because I think if you haven't fermented anything and you look at somebody like you who's dedicated their life to fermentation, it's hard to kind of imagine how to bridge that gap. And I will say that if you do, you know, take a Saturday afternoon or something and do your first fermentation, like it can become something that you don't even have to think about so rapidly. Like just from somebody who's gone through this with different types of ferments, it like can just become something that is part of your, you know, daily or weekly habit, you know, getting ferments going and, you know, very low kind of activation energy once you're all set up and you've gone through it. It's kind of like running an experiment in the lab. The first time you run a new experiment, it's like totally overwhelming. You mess up a ton of stuff. And then the second time you do it, and from then on, it's pretty easy. And so anyway, I don't know if you guys have tips. Actually, there was a question in the Q&A just about weights for holding veggies down. If you have any tips for not having veggies float to the top of brines and get moldy. I know with my, I just made kimchi and the top of it, I did it in a hurry and I forgot to keep the full cabbage leaves to kind of like press down the top. And so the top got kind of moldy. I just scooped it off. It was all kind of like, you know, green light mold. And it was fine as far as I know. But if you have any tips along those lines, both in terms of like getting started, but also maybe specifically about weights, would love to hear it.
Yeah. I mean, there certainly are more and more sort of specialized vessels that are sold now for fermentation that will have an internal weight system. You know, they're going to be a little more expensive, but I think certainly worth it as far as the time to just kind of keep things clean and feel safe about them. But there always are, you know, you can come up in your own kitchen with all sorts of really low tech solutions. Here. This right here is a container full of rocks. And you can certainly, you know, find various containers of various sizes that will fit into other containers. And rocks can easily be removed or added to add or lessen weight. I use containers of rocks all the time, much better than containers of water, which can leak. It's one of actually the questions that people ask all the time. They say, what are the rocks for? And rocks are heavy. And, you know, even something very simple like that. Oh, I lost my sound.
Lost your sound?
I lost my
David, sound. We can't hear you.
You're muted.
Sorry, I muted myself because my fridge came on. There's the glass fermentation weights are great. You know, the ones that you find on Amazon and they have a little handle and you can just throw them in the dishwasher. Fantastic. Don't get me wrong. But I've been doing this since my days at Noma. This is, you can see it keeping the pickles down. It's just like a plastic yogurt cup lid. The neck of the jar applies pressure. You just squeeze it in. It kind of expands once it's underneath the neck. And those pickles aren't going anywhere. And it's just something that I have in my kitchen anyway. Alex, you're totally right. I usually double bag my water. If I'm not a huge fan of water, even though I wrote it into the Noma guide, but I'm like, hey, this is a hack that you can do. Especially because not a lot of people think about this, but when you have a bag of water, the water wants to be water and spill out. And so it applies its pressure sideways on the jar, on the walls of the jar. So you don't always get as much downward pressure as you'd hope, because sometimes the bag just kind of lodges itself and it's like, you know, like James Bond in a, you know, escape vent or something, kind of pressing up against the sides. So yeah, rocks, and you can boil rocks. You can make rocks completely clean and then just throw them in there and it's fine. I mean, that's what people have been doing for hundreds of years. You go to Japan, you go, so you see like pictures of like traditional miso factories. They just have a mountain of rocks on their miso, just a mountain. So yeah. If you can, that's kind of the beauty of fermentation. If you can hack it and it works, then that's your method. There's no right way. Whatever functions is the best thing to do.
Awesome. There's one more question. Actually, there's encouragement, Alex, for you to write a cookbook and share all your wisdom with everybody. That's one comment. And then another question about low salt ferments. Any advice for somebody who's on a low salt diet?
I mean, I tend to, you know, one can certainly use their ferment as the salty part of their meal instead of using additional salt. Doing a low salt ferment, you just have to know that salt is so integral to the process, both of texture preservation and then the preservation of the product over time. You know, if you want to make some quick pickles for yourself, say like a half sour pickle, you know, the reason it's a half sour pickle is because you're using less salt. And so it's souring a little faster. But it just won't be preserved as long. So something like that is a good thing to do at home. But as far as the, you know, salt goes as a variable, you know, it will preserve your product longer over time, and it will allow sort of the progression of bacteria that will happen more slowly to give you sort of the greater flavor depth. But you could certainly do sort of quick pickles that you're enjoying relatively quickly with lower salt at home.
What are trends that you're really excited about in the fermentation space? What are kind of projects that you've seen that you've really enjoyed? And what are things that you think are not going to go anywhere that you've seen people start to work on?
I pay so little attention to what goes on in the outside world. Really, that's Kevin's job. I'm so completely 100% in this world here. It's absolutely the air that I breathe. And eventually, the book it's on the burner. It's been on the burner for a long time. Various different books have been on the burner for a long time. It's a time issue. We want to write it ourselves and we want to photograph it ourselves and we very much want it to be genuinely us. So it will happen at some point. I'm not going to be able to keep up the sort of work schedule I have here forever. And so at some point, you know, the shop will morph into something else and we'll write and we'll perhaps consult and travel and do all the things that we don't have time to do now.
That's great. I personally, think that like every city should have a cultured pepper shop. Not that like you should branch out and build an empire, but that every city should have a fermentary.
I agree.
And when you really think about like the origin of the fermentation and what its role was in traditional societies, you understand it's important. And even it's, you know, sure, there's lots of cities and towns out there that have, you know, the old school butcher. There's one in Copenhagen, like in near the central square, or the fishmonger. Every town needs a fermentary as well. You know, I've been to London and I got to see the London fermentary, and what she's doing over there is fantastic. And it like made my heart pang. And I'm like, why doesn't Copenhagen? Well, now one of my former interns started one in Copenhagen. So that's kind of great as well. But he's really focused on like miso and stuff. But it's just to, if I think Alex, that your sentiments that, you know, it's like, I love the line where you said, you know, when you consume ecosystems regularly and you make those ecosystems feed the ecosystem inside you, you start to see these changes and you know, the real impact of fermentation and health, including in your diet, making it a part of your food groups. And I think the best way to do that is to, when you're not able to do it yourself, have someone dedicated. So if anyone is watching this in the audience and you've been on the fence, it's like, maybe I should follow in her footsteps, do it. Do it for the good of humanity, I would say. We've got just a couple minutes left. Alex, do you have any closing thoughts to round out your talk? It's been such a pleasure having you with us and amazing to hear your story. Anything you want to leave us with?
Just thank you. It's so interesting now that, you know, that fermentation is undergoing such a revival of interest, because really for the majority of our careers, not many people paid attention. We were totally fairly irrelevant in both the sort of mainstream health world and also in sort of the mainstream culinary world. We were kind of weird. And that's how I really have spent most of my professional career. And so to actually have people, you know, pay attention, is amazing. Like it's kind of, I mean, it's kind of funny. It's like what I do hasn't changed that much. But the lens through which people are seeing it has changed a lot. And so actually feeling relevant in the larger conversation is amazing, and I feel fortunate to be a part of it.
Great. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you for being here and sharing that story. And I'm thinking we'll have a lab field trip at some point to come back with you. Yeah.
Thanks so much for joining us for our conversation with Alex Hosven. To see any of the slides mentioned by the speaker, visit us at go2.stanford.edu/fermentation series, or just search for Fermentation Speaker Series Stanford on any search engine for the video recording and sign up for our newsletter. For more conversations like this one, please subscribe on Spotify. If you have any questions, ideas, or comments, we do want to hear from you, so email us at fermentationseries@gmail.com. Music by Sam Fisher. Special thanks to Monica Cryan for her support.